Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
At times she behaved like a great lady, at others like a half-breed. She could dance the minuet or the can-can with equal flair. She was shockingly reckless and promiscuous. The aides told me astonishing tales about her exploits, which Bolivar simply ignored. She was inseparable from her young mulatto slave, who often dressed as a soldier. That coloured girl was the very shadow of her mistress and, possibly, her lover. The girl performed lewd but quite entertaining dances at salon gatherings. And she came and went freely from Manuelita's room. We can imagine why. The Memoirs of Jean-Baptiste Boussingault. Hello, and welcome to The Other Half. Episode 5.16, Manuela Sainz, La Libertadora. Last time, we saw Sally Hemings have to make the ultimate choice between freedom and slavery, ultimately deciding to return to her family in the United States in bondage. She would remain as the enslaved mistress of Thomas Jefferson, who would become the third president of the United States, until his death, when she finally obtained her freedom. Today, we travel down the Americas from north to south to the woman with probably the best nickname of any in this season, the Liberator of the Liberator, Manuela Sainz. While George Washington was the war leader who created a nation, Simon Bolivar is celebrated as the Liberator of Five, and by his side was one of history's great forgotten female revolutionaries. Historians operating in the West and in Latin America, in the English and the Spanish language alike, have all downplayed her influence for over 100 years, with her memory only really preserved in the popular imagination. Her violation of traditional gender norms and involvement in traditionally male spaces have seen her downplayed as a bit part player, or denigrated as a bad apple. Her gender, the circumstances of her birth and transgressive behaviour were seen to tarnish the reputation of the Liberator, whose position on the top perch was beyond reproach. I first discovered Manuela Sainz in Mike Duncan's excellent series on the wars of Spanish American independence in his Revolutions podcast, and I was immediately keen to learn more. I hope in this little series to inspire you as well. But before I get going, I'd like to thank all of my amazing Patreon supporters who keep the show going. If you would like to support the show, then head on over to patreon.com/theotherhalfpodcast, where you can become a patron for as little as a dollar a month. You can also follow the show on Facebook and Twitter, where we post bonus content from the episode, like pictures and maps. To all my new listeners, welcome. To the rest of you, welcome back.
Thank you.
In the West, we tend to think of the countries of Latin America as something of a monolith. We can be guilty of thinking that the people of countries as spread out as Mexico, Colombia, Bolivia, and Chile are more or less the same. However, just as the countries of Europe cannot be grouped together as one, neither can those of Latin America. Like in the Old World, they have divisions of culture and history that have resulted in wars and deep-lying tensions that are maintained to this day. Even in language, where you might have expected there to be some sense of unity, there are differences. If we purely look at South America, almost everyone speaks Spanish, but of course there is the Portuguese spoken in Brazil, not to mention the wealth of native languages. Even among Spanish speakers, there is such a range of dialects and accents that they appear to be almost different tongues. But it didn't have to be this way. The Spanish crown had conquered South America following its quote-unquote discovery by Christopher Columbus's expedition, the tail end of the 15th century. Over the next few centuries, Spain constructed a vast empire built on the exploitation of its abundant natural resources, and was able to do so by the complete subjugation, and in some cases eradication, of its native peoples. Indeed, so great was the impact of this Columbian exchange that they imported millions of enslaved Africans to work on their plantations and mines. However, towards the end of the 18th century, things began to change. Spain had big problems of its own. It had long since left its colonies across the Atlantic to more or less do things their own way. This began to change in the mid-18th century. They set a bureaucratic reforms so wide-ranging that they became known as the Second Conquest. The empire was split into various viceroyalties, with administration staffed not by Creoles, that is, Spanish-descended colonists born in the Americas, but by newcomers from the motherland. The Creoles felt discriminated against, ironic given their own opinion towards the native people of South America, and became restless. In 1780, a mixed-race landowner in Peru called José Gabriel Condorcanqui claimed descent from the continent's native Inca inhabitants. He took the name Tupac Amaru II in memory of the last Inca noble. His revolt was short and brutally suppressed, but it was only the beginning. Quito, the capital of modern Ecuador, was at the centre of this oncoming storm, having had its own revolt against the Spanish in the 1760s. But in 1797, a very different cataclysm hit. An earthquake, measuring around 8 on the Richter scale, almost levelled the city, sending church spires collapsing into the ground and shaking homes into rubble. Thousands upon thousands died, but among the survivors was Joaquina Aizpuru. She was the 18-year-old daughter of a noble family from Quito, who hid a scandalous secret. She was carrying on an affair with the somewhat rakish captain of the city's militia and a member of its governing council. Simón Sáenz de Vergara had been born in the Spanish city of Burgos and had come across the Atlantic to make his fortune. He had married a wealthy heiress and had achieved great success in business that he parlayed into political power. He was respectable, impeccably dressed, and punctilious in his dealings with others. Not the sort of man you'd normally expect to be carrying on this sort of scandalous affair, but here we are. Amongst Quito's rubble, this illicit liaison conceived a child, who in December 1797 was born, turned out to be a girl, and was named Manuela. Joaquina's family were dreadfully embarrassed at their young daughter becoming knocked up, and so Manuela was born in secret, with Joaquina sent to the country to hide her shame. No sooner had she emerged into the world that Manuela was given to the care of the nuns at Quito's La Concepción convent. Sadly, she would not remember her mother. Possibly in childbirth or not long after, Joaquina died. Certainly she was gone by 1804. This left her father as her only caregiver. And many men in this position would have entirely washed their hands of this inconvenient and illegitimate offspring. But not Simón Sáenz de Vergara. In her early years, he provided the money for her acceptance into the convent, where she was given an upper-class upbringing. This was not a home for vagrant youth. This was a school for the Creole elite, where the daughters of all the notable families of Quito were educated. She was also welcomed into his home and introduced to his wife and other children, whom she would regard as her full siblings. She would have less luck with her mother's relatives, who never reconciled themselves to the shame of her birth and grief at Joaquina's untimely death. She had a rebellious streak from a young age. It seems that the initial plan was for her to remain at the convent permanently and take holy orders, but this was nixed when she tried to run off with a young Spanish officer from the garrison. This persuaded her father that perhaps the apple had not fallen so far from the tree. Therefore, it was imperative that he find her a suitable husband. Now, he had already found high-ranking husbands for his two eldest legitimate daughters, but the circumstances of Manuela's birth meant that he would have to set his sights a little lower for her, at least in terms of social station. The lucky man would turn out to be an Englishman called James Thorne. He was a wealthy merchant who had come to Spanish America after the end of the Napoleonic Wars. He was 20 years her senior, and his status as an outsider meant that he was not at all fussed about Manuela's birth. For him and Simón, this was a lucrative business partnership opportunity, with a young and pretty bride thrown in to seal the deal. So, in 1817, at 19 years old, she was sent to Lima, the capital of the Viceroyalty of Peru, the smallest of the three viceroyalties of South America at the time. It covered the modern countries of Chile and Peru, and controlled most of the continent's Pacific seaboard. To the north was the Viceroyalty of New Granada, which covered Ecuador, Colombia, Panama, and Venezuela. And to the south and east was the Viceroyalty of the Rio de la Plata, which contained Argentina, Uruguay, Bolivia, and Paraguay. While theirs was the epitome of a marriage of convenience, it was pretty convenient for both parties. For Manuela, it gave her a respectable position in a provincial capital as the wife of a notable man and mistress of a prominent and wealthy household. She was presented to the viceroy, attended all the right social gatherings, and was by all accounts a popular figure in high society. They would have made for a slightly odd couple to modern eyes. He, a portly, stuffy, middle-aged Englishman. She, a young and fiery, ambitious Ecuadorian. But such a match was common back then. By all accounts, James Thorne adored and respected his young wife. In letters, he described her as, quote, most beloved wife of my heart, and, quote, my darling companion. He also involved her in his business dealings. His line of work necessarily meant that he was away a lot. In his absence, Manuela would act as his proxy, making purchases, buying stock, and generally running his business. In 1820, she was granted power of attorney over his affairs while he was away. Above all, she was an expert negotiator and saleswoman. All of this gave her a great deal of autonomy. As she grew in competence and confidence, she began to take more and more notice of the rumblings going on around her, and listen more closely to the radical views of some of the more exciting guests at her parties. Okay, so I'm going to have to summarise a lot of history very quickly, so here goes. Spain had been allied with Napoleonic France, but in 1808, the Corsican corporal invaded Spain, forcing the abdication of its king, placing his brother on the throne, and opening up an ulcer that would eventually bleed him dry. While the motherland struggled to regain its independence with the help of the British, the Spanish Empire was left to fend for itself. Once news of this reached the colonies, there was chaos. They were all agreed that Joseph Bonaparte was not going to be their king. But if not him, then who? Back in Spain, various rebel governments or juntas had formed, but did they have any more legitimate right over the rules of subjects thousands of miles away? Surely now was the time to seize the day and win the right to govern themselves. Over the next few years, armed rebellions broke out across Spanish America, from Mexico in the north to Patagonia in the south. In South America, there were two foremost rebel leaders: Simón Bolívar, operating out of Caracas, modern Venezuela, and José de San Martín, operating out of Buenos Aires, in modern Argentina. Those were in the other two viceroyalties. Peru was the centre of the royalist forces, and Lima became the de facto Spanish capital in South America. Even after Spain won its independence from France, and Napoleon met his Waterloo, the flames of revolution could not be extinguished. While Bolívar will become key to our story later, we will focus first on San Martín. After taking control of the forces of Buenos Aires, San Martín led an expedition over the Andes that liberated Chile, and then marched north towards Peru. Now, James Thorne was not sympathetic to the rebel cause. As a proud and temperate Englishman, he, of course, highly disapproved of rebellion. And as a devout Catholic, he was more sympathetic to the cause of God and the king than of patriotic republicanism, which often took a heretically anti-clerical bent. You may have expected Manuela, as his wife and the daughter of a Spanish officer, to have held similar loyalties. But her rebellious streak led her down a different path. While she had grown up as a member of the upper crust, she had always been an outsider. She had never forgotten how she had been treated by her mother's family, who still now denied her any inheritance rights from her mother. There were also those in Quito and Lima society that had always looked down on her because of her birth. This all radicalized her against the establishment and led her to yearn for a new order to emerge. She was joined in this by her half-brother, José María, who had followed his father into a military career, but whose loyalties were increasingly with the rebels rather than Spain. Thorne was aware of his wife's revolutionary views, and it appears he ordered her to fall in line, the first sign of cracks in their relationship. Manuela ignored him. She joined with several other Republican women in a campaign of seduction, basically using their womanly wiles to entice members of the city garrison to defect. Precisely what she did to induce them to switch sides is a little unclear, but she was clearly very persuasive. She used her connections and contacts effectively, becoming a valuable spy for San Martín in Lima, providing vital intelligence. She and her friends were so successful in undermining the loyalty of the city garrison that in July 1821, the viceroy was forced to withdraw what was left of his army from the city, allowing San Martín to march in unopposed. The victorious general knew who he had to thank for his victory, honouring Manuela by awarding her the Order of the Sun. This was an order of Peru's greatest patriots, all of whom had provided vital service to the revolution. The men of this society got government pensions and offices. Manuela just got a red and white sash and a medal. But this decoration symbolised a new nobility for a nascent regime. While before she had hobnobbed with countesses and marchionesses and other women with lofty titles who looked down on this illegitimate Englishman's wife, now she could gaze down on them from her lofty heights as a heroine of the revolution. The following year, Manuela and her husband travelled north, with James stopping off in Guayaquil to do business of some kind, and she continuing on to her home city of Quito. The thorny issue of her inheritance was still rumbling on, and she was having no luck getting the money that was rightfully hers from Lima. When she left Peru, Quito was still under Spanish occupation, but by the time she arrived, it had been liberated by the other great South American revolutionary, Simón Bolívar. Simon Bolivar was the embodiment of the Creole elite. Born in Caracas in 1783, he was a member of one of Venezuela's oldest, noblest, and wealthiest families. He had had the best education money could buy. He had travelled extensively across Europe, where he was exposed to some of the revolutionary thought that would lead to him becoming a rebel leader. In 1811, he led a revolt in Caracas that led to the formation of the First Venezuelan Republic. That only lasted a year before it was crushed by the Spanish. He escaped west to New Granada, basically modern Colombia, and from there led a decade-long war that saw many atrocities on both sides, particularly the Spanish. He had no military training to speak of, but was a natural leader. Though his campaigns ended in disaster, as often as they ended in success, he never stopped trying, sinking his entire fortune and entire self into the enterprise. By 1822, with the help of a combination of cowboys from the interior, British mercenaries, and soldiers from the newly independent Republic of Haiti, he managed to drive the Spanish out of Colombia, Panama, Venezuela, and Ecuador, uniting all the territory into a new state called Gran Colombia, with him named as his first president. Bolivar had grand ambitions. Much like the United States of the North, he wanted to unite the Spanish colonies in the Americas into superstates, governed by liberal republican constitutions. An unlikely fusion of Washington and Napoleon, Simon Bolivar was the most famous man on the continent. And when he marched into Quito on the 16th of June 1822, it was as a liberating hero. The city was awash with the red, blue, and gold flags of Gran Colombia, and the central plaza was packed to the gills to hear the liberator speak, while the rich and powerful dressed up in their glad rags to dance with him and his officers at a private ball. Of course, while conquest comes with glory, it also comes with a lot of admin. He was the new power in town, so everyone came to him looking to solve their problems. It wasn't easy to get an audience with a liberator, but luckily for Manuela, she had an in. Her brother, José María, had recently joined Bolivar's staff as an aide-de-camp, and through him, she managed to secure some time with the great man. The man she encountered was not the dashing hero one might have expected. He was 39 years old, 14 years her senior, with dark tan skin and narrow features. What he lacked in looks, however, he more than made up for in charm. One does not inspire a continent-wide revolution without quite some personal aura. He was a man who was constantly thinking and always on the move. He was an inspiring leader, an eloquent speaker, and a fierce intellect. Most of all, though, he was tough. Although he had grown up in pampered luxury, he had endured all kinds of physical and mental hardship during his long revolutionary career. It had been a long, painful road, but now was time to celebrate. He was a widower and had been for some years. He had met his wife, Maria Teresa, while living in Spain as a student. However, when he brought her across the Atlantic to live with him in Venezuela, she caught yellow fever and died. He vowed never to marry again. While for Thomas Jefferson this was a promise his wife bade him make, it appears this was his choice. He had slumped into a dark place when his wife had died. He had lost his parents while young, and it seems that he could not stomach the idea of losing another wife. This did not mean that he remained chaste. Far from it. In the words of his biographer, Victor von Hagen, quote, "Women were vital to Simon Bolivar. He was never without them, at home, abroad, even on his military expeditions. After the death of his wife, he said, 'I shall never marry again.' And he kept that vow, giving himself freely to passion, but avoiding like the plague any semblance of a lasting emotional tie." Legend has it that they were introduced at the Victory Ball. Many of Bolivar's officers were British mercenary soldiers who had cut their teeth fighting Napoleon's armies in Spain. Thanks to her husband, Manuela spoke fluent English, and using a coarse ton, she told them risque stories that had everyone roaring with laughter. This caught Bolivar's attention, and he invited her to dance with him. Once they had begun to dance, the whole room shrank. They only had eyes for each other, and remained dancing for the rest of the night, all the while the rest of the room whispered at this new scandal. By the time they slipped away, everyone knew what it was they were about to do. Now, this is a tremendous story, but while it is often repeated, there is no real evidence to say that it actually happened. The trope of two lovers meeting at a dance is a very popular one, and it may well be that this is a later romantic invention. But we have no more accurate version than this. This is all we have. However, and wherever they met, their chemistry was off the charts. He, the charismatic liberator, she, the young, attractive, free-spirited, good-time girl. They are both intelligent, well-read, and curious, but restless minds that few others could keep up with. What primarily drew them together, though, was their sense of humour. Manuela was famously a right laugh and never took herself too seriously. Bolivar would later say that while he loved her for her, quote, delicious attractions, he was more attracted to her, quote, delightful temperament and, quote, enchanting spirit. He famously told her, quote, Madam, if only my soldiers had your marksmanship, we would have routed Spain long ago. For Manuela, Bolivar was the antithesis of her husband. Where he was a dour, dull, overweight English businessman, Bolivar was a charismatic, fit, and passionate revolutionary. Thorne had been her ticket out of Quito, but Bolivar would be her ticket into the history books. So they hit it off and immediately began a sexual relationship. They were two energetic and enigmatic characters who defied anyone's attempts to control them. They had never before found their match. They were kindred spirits in a way, but of course, being the passionate and independent people they were, the flames of passion could burn with pain just as easily. Their affair, though, was cut short by the demands of duty. Bolivar had designs on the port city of Guayaquil, but San Martin had other ideas. The Argentine general demanded that the two negotiate in person, the first and indeed only meeting between South America's two great liberators. So Bolivar left in something of a hurry, wanted to get to the city before San Martin did. Always best to have possession of the field first. Manuela, it seems, though, believed he had an ulterior motive for leaving so suddenly. She wrote to him, openly expressing her love and longing. Sadly, we don't have the letter, but we do have his reply. Quote, I want to answer, most beautiful Manuela, your demands of love, which are entirely reasonable. But I have to be candid with you, who have given me so much of yourself. It's time you knew that. Long ago, I loved a woman as only the young can love. Out of respect, I never talk about it. I'm pondering these things, and I want to give you the time to do the same. Because your words lure me, because I know this may well be my moment to love you, and for us to love one another. I need time to get used to this, for a military life is neither easy to endure nor easy to leave behind. I have fooled death so many times, now that death dogs my every step. Allow me to be sure of myself, of you. I cannot lie, I never lie. My passion for you is wild, and you know it. Give me time. Manuela was a woman in love and not afraid to say it. She didn't give a damn what society thought. She never had. Bolivar's loss made him avoid commitment. Instead, he threw himself into his revolutionary cause. But now he had a chance of real personal happiness for the first time since he had lost his wife. And that scared him. Of course, the disadvantage of falling for a charismatic revolutionary general is that they tend to be away a lot. You know, fighting their revolution. And while she was not with him over the next few months, this did not mean that she was not helping him. The conference between Bolivar and San Martin at Guayaquil was an event of seismic importance. and Bolívar was keen to know as much about the Argentine general as possible. Who better to give him the inside scoop than Manuela? She had been vital to San Martín's capture of Lima, and had spent a great deal of time with him as he established his rule over the city. She saw his strengths, but also his flaws, his drug dependency, his pro-monarchical views, and recurrent illnesses. More to the point, she knew that Lima was on the verge of rebelling against San Martín, and this crucial intelligence allowed Bolívar to gain the upper hand in his negotiations. Indeed, it went so well that Bolívar managed not only to secure Guayaquil for Gran Colombia, but San Martín would end up leaving the continent, going into retirement back in Europe. Bolívar and Manuela continued to exchange letters like lovesick teenagers, but could not spend much time together over the next few months. She remained in Quito, ignoring her husband's pleas to return to Lima so that she could stay as close as possible to Bolívar, but their trysts were still few and far between. Meanwhile, a royalist rebellion against Bolívar had broken up in the Pasto region of Colombia, requiring the liberator's attention. She wrote to him, quote, "The victory at Yanquanquer has cost me dearly. You'll tell me I'm not a good patriot for what I'm about to say, but I would have preferred my own triumph to 10 in Pasto. I can imagine how bored you must be in that little town, but as desperate as you may be, you cannot possibly be as desperate as your best of friends." In the year following their first meeting, they were only together around 5 times. And while those occasions were whirlwinds of passion, they were not enough to satisfy Manuela. Moreover, she knew Bolívar by reputation. He was a notorious womanizer, and he didn't want his eye to wander too much. Indeed, she had already caught wind of a rumoured fling between Bolívar and a teenager rather unhelpfully called Manuelita. She wrote to Bolívar's secretary, Juan José Santana, quote, "I feel miserable," and that she was, quote, "ready to do something crazy," and she, quote, "might even die of this." In October 1823, she finally got her wish. Lima had fallen to royalist forces, and with San Martín now out of the picture, it fell to Bolívar to win it back. She, of course, knew Lima well, and persuaded Bolívar to let her join his personal entourage as his archivist. This made her almost unique as a woman holding such an important position in a general's staff. Women would sometimes accompany their husbands or lovers on campaign. They may have been hostesses for the officers, done domestic tasks, even taken up arms in some cases. But very rarely were they given a formal salaried role. However, this was one she was more than qualified for. Remember, she had basically run her husband's business with great success, and she was also a fast learner. Speaking of her husband, you may be wondering what he thought about all of this. Well, shockingly, he wasn't a fan. He did everything he could to persuade his wife to return to him, but no amount of begging, bribing, or threatening could entreat her. She wrote to him, quote, "No, no, 1,000 times no. Sir, you are an excellent person. Indeed, one of a kind that I will never deny. I only regret that you are not a better man, so that my leaving you would honour Bolívar more. I know very well that I can never be joined to him in what you call honour. Do you think I am any less honourable because he is my lover and not my husband? Ah, I do not live by social conventions men construct to torment us. So leave me be, my dear Englishman. We will marry again in heaven, but not on this earth. On earth, you are a boring man. Up there, in the celestial heights, everything will be so English, because a life of monotony was invented for you people, who make love without pleasure, conversation without grace, who walk slowly, greet solemnly, move heavily, joke without laughing. With all the sobriety, truth, and clarity of an Englishwoman, I say now, I will never return to you." That is about as direct a breakup letter as you could ever hope to read. Or hope never to read, I guess. She was now on the march with Bolivar, sharing in his hardships and what would be his final military campaign. They were still not always together. She would often travel around a day's ride behind the army when it was on the move. But when it stopped to plan and strategize, she would be with Bolivar. The going was tough, but so was she. This, of course, meant that she was not present at any of the campaign's battles, including the decisive victory at the Battle of Ayacucho, where the last great royalist Spanish army on the continent was finally defeated. The Peruvian Congress gratefully named Simón Bolívar as the President of Peru, adding to his title of President of Gran Colombia. One might have expected this to mean that, finally, the two lovers could be together. But it seems that in his hour of victory, Bolívar got cold feet. He wrote to her that, quote, "I can see that nothing in the world can unite us under the auspices of innocence and honour. A cruel but just fate demands our mutual separation. Let us not be guilty any longer." It's not certain what brought this on, but it appears to be a mixture of genuine concern for Manuela's reputation and for his own. While illicit affairs such as theirs were not unusual, especially not in times of such upheaval, it was normally expected that they'd be conducted more discreetly. Manuela was not a woman given to discretion. She was known as La Libertadora, the female form of the Liberator. She felt that she had earned her right to live her life as she wanted. She was open in her love, and this scandal was on everyone's lips. Bolivar's breakup may also have been a reaction to James Thorne's constant entreaties, who appears to have swallowed his pride and appealed to his wife's lover's sense of honour. No matter how much and how fervently Manuela told him that their marriage was over, Thorne would not relent. And his wife was just as relentless in her pursuit of her affair with Bolivar. She knew that whatever he said, she had captured his heart. She was not ready for this to end. This would be over when she said it was over. Things came to a head in February 1826. Manuela told Bolivar that she was about to embark on a trip to London, presumably with her husband. After all, he had told Manuela she should reconcile with him. Well, now she was leaving, possibly forever. This was an extremely high-stakes move and was probably a double bluff, which worked an absolute charm. Bolivar, confronted with the reality that he may never see the woman he loved again, wrote to her, quote, "My adored one, will you not answer me clearly concerning your terrible trip to London? Don't be enigmatic, tell me the truth. Don't go anywhere, not even with God himself. I too want to see you and see you again, and touch you and smell you and taste you, and unite you to me in all the senses. You are the only woman for me." Of course, Manuela did not go to London. Quite probably she never had intended on doing so. And this marked an important change in her relationship with Bolivar. She was finally able to move into her own house near his headquarters in Lima, firmly establishing them as a couple. They were now together day and night, with Manuela not only working as his archivist, but also receiving his guests. As I said before, conquest comes with a lot of admin, and there was a never-ending stream of petitioners seeking the Liberator's attention, help, and patronage. She hosted balls and receptions and organised private dinners. In short, she was the de facto First Lady of Peru. She also advocated for her own causes. While on campaign with Bolivar, she became concerned with the needs of his men, especially the wounded and junior officers, who were not as well paid or rewarded as their superiors, who had easier access to Bolivar. She became their conduit, a means for the disadvantaged to gain the ear of the Liberator. By 1826, though, this domestic bliss was interrupted by a new threat. Bolivar had not been elected as president of Peru. He had been essentially named dictator in order to lead the fight against royalist forces and entrench the new republic. However, the Spanish were gone now, and the Peruvian elite was getting increasingly irked by this foreigner ruling over them. He was surrounded by soldiers and administrators who were from Gran Colombia, not Peru. He was also a well-known federalist. He wanted to see South America ruled by giant superstates, and the rich and powerful in Lima had no wish to see themselves united with Gran Colombia. They also feared Bolivar's growing autocratic tendencies. The previous year, Upper Peru had declared its independence, with its assembly calling the new nation Bolivia, and Bolivar naming himself president for life. The new constitution that Bolivar drafted for this new country that bore his name did not imbue the president with a great deal of powers, but it did contain an extremely restrictive suffrage and a government that would be stuffed with Bolivarian loyalists. Later the same year, the same constitution was imposed on Peru itself, naming Bolivar president for life there as well. This simmering discontent broke out into open revolt in January 1827. While Bolivar was away in Gran Colombia, junior officers and soldiers within the 3rd Division of his army mutinied, led by a Colombian colonel named José Bustamante. Their demands were mainly due to lack of pay and overly harsh discipline. But once they had taken control of central Lima, they were soon joined by civilian allies, who abolished the hated Bolivarian constitution and demanded that all Colombian troops leave Peru. With Bolivar far away in Bogota, Manuela Sainz was responsible for responding to this threat. She dressed herself in a colonel's uniform and exhorted the troops that remained at Bolivar's headquarters to remain loyal to the liberator. She also removed Bolivar's personal archive from the city and distributed what money she had to try and organize a campaign of resistance. She was personally popular with junior officers and the rank and file, having gained their respect by sharing their hardships on campaign. Indeed, she had so much success in this mini campaign of resistance that the new Peruvian authorities sent troops to arrest her. At midnight on the 7th of February, soldiers stormed Manuela's house and placed her under arrest. She was escorted back to Lima and put in a convent. She did not go quietly, and once in the convent, she issued a stream of indignant letters protesting her treatment. She demanded to know on what basis she was being detained, pointing out that she had not been accused of any crime. Under the new constitution that the Peruvian Congress had just reimposed, if someone had not been told the reason for their arrest within 24 hours, they were entitled to go free. Moreover, as a citizen of Gran Colombia, she argued she was entitled to be treated with consideration under international law. If she had not already found her calling as a businesswoman, revolutionary, soldier, and politician, she could easily have been a successful lawyer. Her persistence paid off, and she was released from the convent in March, but would not be allowed to go free. The new foreign minister was particularly scathing of her, calling Manuela, quote, scandalous, an insult to public honour and morals. She was packed onto a ship, along with over 100 Colombian soldiers bound for Guayaquil. Though not her native land, Peru had become a second home for Manuela. She had played a vital part in winning its freedom. She was La Libertadora. But that chapter in her life was over. The next one would be no less turbulent.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.